Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Skiing into the Bright Open, My Solo Journey to the South Pole, by Liv Arneson. Foreword by Anne Bancroft, translated by Roland Huntford, narrated by Anne Richardson. The one who has felt the eternal receding circle of the horizon has understood the essence of freedom, never to be satisfied, but always to move the boundaries further out somewhere. Nordahl Grieg. Foreword. Anne Bancroft. At long last, the story of Liv Arneson's groundbreaking expedition to the South Pole has been published in English to share with an entirely new audience. First published in Norway in 1995, this account of a remarkable history-making solo adventure is told with understated grace by a no less remarkable woman. Liv recounts her journey from dream to reality through her journal entries. Inspired by the polar history she loves, Liv weaves the tapestry of her endeavor with those who went before, combining her own life experiences both on and off the ice. Through these stories, we come to see just how Liv's mind and spirit work. I first met Liv in 1998 when she took me up on an invitation to come to Minnesota and talk about a project I was launching to cross Antarctica. We knew of each other despite the ocean between us. In 1992-93, I had led a team of American women to the South Pole, and as this book details, Liv would follow solo and unsupported the following season. At the time, only a few women around the globe were pushing into the male domain of the polar regions, so we found it easy to learn about each other. My goal in the early 1990s was to cross the continent of Antarctica, inspired as a girl by the book Endurance, about Ernest Shackleton's ill-fated attempt to do the same in 1914-15. Like Liv, I experienced an insurmountable wall to getting the project funded. Convincing possible sponsors with societal norms in the boardrooms to follow our dreams was considerably harder than life on the ice. Climbing over the attitudinal barriers about what women can and cannot do was far more arduous than the sastrugi and headwinds that Antarctica would dish out. Grassroots support from people who believed in four women would get us funded as far as the South Pole in 1992-93, but our hopes of changing corporate America's mind once we had made our midway point at the pole and proved our mettle did not, ultimately, loosen the needed sponsorship dollars for the second half of our journey across the continent. Before leaving the South Pole for home, through tears of disappointment, I would scratch new plans in the back of my journal for returning for the traverse. My plan called for trimming the team to just two people to move fast and efficiently. Although our team returned home to a fanfare of delight and celebration as the first women to ski to the South Pole, I had colliding feelings of success and failure that only I seemed to possess. People were thrilled by our achievement, and the goal of the traverse was all but forgotten. I would have to trust that one day my time would come again to actualize the full dream. That time did finally arrive. 7 years later, seduced by the wide-open expanses, I started to lay the framework, not just on the ice, but in the marketing departments, that could help support efforts both on the journey and in classrooms around the world. I would no longer wait for those who dared not step into the future. With no aspirations for a solo crossing, I began to think of a teammate. I immediately thought of Liv, remembering how beautifully she had executed her South Pole expedition. I have often joked that if one is seeking success in the polar regions, partner with a Norwegian. And in this case, it's no joke, and Liv is so much more. Having joined the ranks of Nansen and Amundsen as a skilled, strong skier who executed an almost flawless expedition, and having traveled alone for 50 days, she proved she could be self-sufficient and, just as important, enjoy herself while doing it. These were qualities I felt necessary for a team of just two. Meeting her for the first time, however, I was totally intimidated, and rather than exuding confidence when I met her at the airport, I became totally shy. Once we began to walk and talk, fortunately my shyness faded and was replaced by excitement of the possibilities we could achieve together. We discovered on our walks that we were both drawn to the outdoors and sport at an early age, and that we both had parents who nurtured their unusual daughters. We discovered that the same books of early polar expeditions had fed our imaginations of beautiful, distant, and vast ice scapes. We'd both become educators, and as women of polar firsts, we each felt a stir to use the platform we felt so privileged to stand on in a larger, more sustainable way. This awakening to pushing boundaries beyond the physical and geographical had started for me after standing at the North Pole in 1986, the first known woman to do so. I felt a strong pull at the time to use the flurry of attention from my accomplishment to do something within my passion, but bigger than myself and my personal ambitions. When I launched our all-women's trip to Antarctica in 1992, I followed through on this promise by developing curriculum to help share the journey and inspire young people to their own dreams and potential. While listening to Leave talk about her feelings coming home from her solo journey and how she felt similar desires to broaden the work beyond herself, I knew she was beyond perfect as a teammate for the biggest challenge of my career. These similarities began to forge our friendship with a bedrock foundation of certainly our passions, but also now of a larger purpose. Leave's account of her time on the ice gives the listener a solid sense of the woman I have been fortunate to travel with on many expeditions for more than 2 decades. Her towering inner strength, her courage and calm in the face of adversity, and her endless curiosity about what's over the horizon all make for an amazing expedition. She overcomes not only the obstacles of the continent, but also those of cultural, sexist, and economic prejudices in pursuing her dreams, motivated by a passion for life and a desire to share it to make the world a better place. Leave writes with a direct style and an attention to detail. Her ability to be present in the landscape and the space around her created a sense of peace in the silent expanse for 50 days. This can belie the hazards and the margin of error of being alone, but it speaks volumes to her comfort in wild spaces and with herself. Leave's story, like her place in history, will stand the test of time. Perhaps the biggest discovery for me in rereading Leave's account is that while growing up, I held dreams seemingly no one else shared. And now I have learned over the thin line of the horizon that there was another, my soul sister. Prologue. Christmas Eve. The Amundsen Scott base has been visible for 5 hours. The dome grows bigger, and more buildings appear. I cross the landing strip, and for the first time on the whole tour, I feel my skis gliding and make my first double heave on the poles. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Chilean time, which I've been following throughout my expedition. At home in Norway, it's 8 o'clock in the evening, and people are perhaps just finishing Christmas dinner. The Amundsen Scott base follows New Zealand time, so here it's actually early in the morning on Christmas Day. the gleaming blue dome of the base, all the lines of tents, and the many cargo depots strewn around form a striking contrast to the image I have on my retina of Amundsen and his men standing at attention before their tent and the flag. I see the dome on my right. On my left, I notice the well-known sign at the geographical South Pole. I haven't a single thought in my head, but 10 meters from the geographical point, the emotions rise. The tears stream during the last few meters to the pole, and when I arrive, I lean over my ski poles and cry my heart out. I have nursed this dream for so long that I am quite prepared for my arrival at the South Pole to be an anticlimax. My thoughts are with those at home. I'm profoundly happy for their sake. Soon they will be able to relax and enjoy Christmas. The Americans at the base will send a message to Patriot Hill's base camp, and the news of my arrival will quickly be relayed to Norway. At last, I can be certain that Einar and everyone else at home will know that all is well. I've sent my reports, as agreed, every single day for 50 days, but I have no idea whether they got through. It's been a wonderful experience to be a lonely nomad in Antarctica. The days passed incredibly quickly, though I do remember the overwhelming fatigue and emptiness of the first few days. I sense another kind of emptiness now, as if something has been lost. Mentally, I feel as if I still have enormous reserves. I feel privileged to have gone through this experience. Above all, to have realized a dream. Fruit is best enjoyed when ripe. As I look back now on my expedition to the South Pole in 1994, it seems rather strange that it took so long before I dared set out on my long journeys. By the time I was 20 years old, I had enjoyed extensive, varied experiences in the outdoors. But it wasn't until I was 37 that I made my first attempt to cross Greenland. Why had I waited so long? Long before my own trip to Greenland, I had read about Carl Emil Pettersen, the Norwegian who accomplished the first solo crossing of Greenland on skis. Why hadn't I simply followed his example? I had dreamed of the South Pole since I was quite young, so why hadn't I set off earlier? In retrospect, there were many reasons, one of the most important being that I wasted many years discussing and planning with men. The first modern South Pole expeditions I read about were the expedition of Roger Meir, Robert Swan, and Gareth Wood in 1985, recounted in The Footsteps of Scott, Monica Christensen's abortive attempt in 1989, and the journey by Will Steger and his international party in 1990, detailed in Crossing Antarctica. All these expeditions had insanely high budgets, which perhaps convinced me that it was better to let my dream remain a dream. The turning point came when another Norwegian, Erling Kaga, made the first solo journey to the South Pole, which he did with apparent ease, and kept to a reasonable budget in the bargain. I knew I was just as good a skier as Erling was, and at least as experienced on glaciers. Did I really want to go to the South Pole, or did I prefer to continue dreaming? It wasn't an academic question. I should explain something about our national psyche. Many Norwegians have a tendency to live in the twilight world between imagination and reality, and sometimes to confuse the two. In fact, one of Ibsen's great dramas, Peer Gynt, is based on this theme. I often wonder what finally enabled me to escape from that twilight world and turn my dream into a concrete plan. It was a plan that required relentless training, extensive practical preparation, and a great deal of drudgery, all of which wasn't easy to fit in with a full-time job and my other responsibilities. In the oft-quoted words of Ecclesiastes, "To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven." Perhaps the answer is simply that earlier the time just wasn't right. the older you grow, the better you know yourself. Eventually, or at least hopefully, you discover your own ability and your own talents. Everyone is capable of something. Some are skilled with their hands, others with their brains, still others with their legs. It's inspiring to seize an opportunity if you believe in it. You might not succeed, but in any case, you will have tried. It's been said that today's mental ability is tomorrow's agility. Everyone derives pleasure and use from some form of mental training. It's helped me enormously in a variety of circumstances. There are various methods, and since we're all different, each of us has to discover what suits us best. As a result of injury, I had back trouble when I was young. It recurred when I started my studies at the Norwegian School of Sports Sciences. But by means of autogenic training, I diverted attention from the back pain to something else. I repeated the syllabus by heart, or I immersed myself in a daydream. My attention didn't always circle around the South Pole, but I was nearly always out on some faraway journey or other. The worst betrayal is the one committed against yourself by ignoring your abilities. It's just as important to respect yourself as it is to respect others. If you constantly feel that you're compromising with yourself, it's difficult to mean anything to others. I hope that my ski tour to the South Pole may prove to others, especially young women, that most things are possible, even when they venture into strange arenas. To fulfill a dream, it must be converted into a goal, so that one may start planning. Hard work then follows. Most ambitions can be realized as long as your motives are strong enough and genuine. Ski touring between the covers of a book. Ever since I was quite young, I've devoted a great deal of energy to daydreaming. My family remembers me as a quiet child, somewhat withdrawn, determined, and not a little obstinate. I remember that I always found it easy to invent games outdoors, and that it was more fun to climb the huge chestnut tree in the yard than to play with dolls. My games were often different from those usually associated with nice little girls. A playful uncle who wasn't much older than me and the boys up the road always let me join them in building forts, playing cowboys and Indians, or engaging in other make-believe activities. In short, I was a bit of a tomboy. At the same time, my interest in the great wide open spaces of the world grew out of the stories I heard as a child and the books I read when I grew older. The first dream of exploration I remember was as a 6-year-old, one about my own expedition. I had been to the cinema with my father to see the documentary of Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki expedition of 1947. I think I had mixed the movie with a Norwegian song about children from around the world. My plan as a 6-year-old was to travel on all the oceans and meet kids from all over the globe. I also recall what I thought I should bring as food on my expedition, all kinds of chocolate, cake, and the goodies I loved that my parents only let us have on Saturdays. I don't recall whether I had thought at all about bringing fresh water. The following year, on a trip overseas with my family, I experienced seasickness for the first time, killing the dream of my first expedition. Later, when I was in 5th grade, my class watched the Kon-Tiki documentary, and I recalled my old dream. The documentary was nothing like I remembered, and I started to read about and follow Thor Heyerdahl's projects. Today, I am a board member of the Thor Heyerdahl Institute, and in 2015 I joined a scientific expedition that planned to go from Peru to Easter Island and on south, and then drift back to Chile. I was on the raft starting from Easter Island until we were rescued by the Chilean Armada when the ropes holding together the balsa logs started to rot. We spent 72 days on the Pacific on the raft without seeing a ship. I read 30 books in that time, and I loved my watches under the starry nights. My childhood dream had come true. Reading about great feats and tragedies in the Arctic and Antarctic had already become a burning interest for me when I was a child. And the older I grew, the more interesting I found these books about Scott, Nansen, and Shackleton. Gradually, I began to understand that those old characters were just like the rest of us when it came to describing an expedition. And the more participants involved in an expedition, the more versions available about what really happened. After the first official reports and diaries of expedition leaders had been published, the original records and those of other participants eventually became available too. Amundsen was rather diplomatic when he described the drama that unfolded at his Antarctic base at Framheim after the abortive start for the South Pole in September 1911. Scott couldn't bring himself to admit that he'd made any mistakes, even during the last days of his life, with his dead companions beside him. Doubts still hang over Admiral Byrd's flights, supposedly the first of their kind, to the North and South Poles. As the years pass, more sources are uncovered, and we continually have more answers as to what really happened. As with all history, it's this unraveling that makes polar history so fascinating. When I was 8 years old, my father, a builder, had to do some maintenance work at Polhøgda, Fridtjof Nansen's home at Lysaker, outside Oslo, and I accompanied him. Compared to other countries, Norway doesn't have many historical buildings, but Polhøgda is one of them. Likewise, Nansen is our national hero, and it's perhaps characteristic that he was neither a soldier nor a political leader, but a skiing pioneer and the founder of modern polar exploration, in that order. On that first visit to Polhøgda, we were shown around, and what fixed itself especially in my memory was seeing Nansen's study in the tower, the leading feature of the building. I remember the desk, chair, pens, and picture of Nansen's wife, Eva, an accomplished singer who gave some of Edvard Grieg's compositions their first performance, dressed for the concert stage. Everything was as Nansen had left it when he died in May 1930 of a heart attack. In that room, events played out that have virtually become part of Norwegian folklore. There, one day in 1907, Nansen sat on the horns of a dilemma as he waited for Roald Amundsen to arrive. Nansen was to give Amundsen an answer to his request for the loan of Fram, the ship that Nansen had specially built for his historic Arctic drift of 1893-96. Amundsen wanted to make an attempt on the North Pole. Nansen had designs on the South Pole. On his way down to receive Amundsen, Nansen passed Eva in the gallery, and she said, "I know very well what you have decided." That persuaded Nansen to change his mind. He descended the last few steps and received Amundsen with the words, "You shall have Fram." Meanwhile, in 1909, Frederick Cook and Robert E. Peary returned from the Arctic, both claiming to have reached the North Pole. Cook was later unmasked as a fraud, and to this day it's a matter of dispute whether Peary actually reached the pole. At that point, Amundsen had decided in all secrecy to turn around and make for the South Pole instead. It is part of the story that Nansen, having been intimately involved in the bloodless achievement of Norwegian independence from Sweden in 1905, looked forward to another polar expedition. He wrote to Amundsen after Amundsen returned from the Antarctic, having won the race for the South Pole in December 1911. "I have really done my best for you and your expedition. I can say what you perhaps have not understood, that I have made a greater sacrifice for you than for any other living person, in that I gave up my expedition to the South Pole, the crown of my work as a polar explorer, and renounced Fram so that you could carry out your drift over the polar sea. You might think that was not much, but you might consider that it was a plan that I had already considered before sailing on Fram, and which I had planned in all its detail in the hut on Franz Josef's land. Returning home from my visit to Polhögda, I immediately started to read Nansen's book, The First Crossing of Greenland. His Greenland expedition was the historic opening of modern polar exploration, but the book's old Danish-Norwegian literary language was probably a little heavy for an 8-year-old. The next day I got hold instead of a school edition of Amundsen's account of his expedition to the South Pole. I drank in every word, and doubtless, from that moment, felt a kind of attraction to the far horizons, solitude, cold, and elements. In addition to Amundsen's description of the ski tour to the South Pole, what particularly fascinated me in his book was the building of the base at Framheim. The stores and workshops under the snow and all the details of equipment made for exciting reading. It was all about preparation and execution down to the tiniest detail. But I think what most attracted me to Amundsen's story was the idea of being underway for so long. It meant being alone and independent with everything that you need. Tent, food, sleeping bag, cook stove, and fuel. It meant being able to manage with simple means. Much later, I was able to give this a name, a sense of freedom. After this literary experience, I began my expedition life through books. Like other teenage girls, I also read what were considered girls' stories, but I thought that polar literature was much more interesting. I was always hunting for books about girls who had done something similar. Once I found a book called Amor on Skis. That was before I knew who Amor really was, the Norwegian version of Cupid, but Amor is also slang for a mother. So I thought the book was about a mother on skis. It turned out to be about girls falling like ninepins as soon as a good-looking boy appeared on the slopes. That book was my first and greatest literary disappointment. Finding my own way. Many years later, when I was 30 years old, it was like seeing the light when I read in the newspaper about Carl Emil Pettersen, whose solo ski tour across Greenland in 1983 sounded splendid, and he was 58 years old to boot. It was a revelation. Carl Emil was a seasoned traveler, but I knew I was also a reliable skier with plenty of stamina. Why couldn't I also ski across Greenland? I remember that day so well. I was sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee and the local paper in front of me. My partner sat directly opposite me, immersed in local news. But I was already on my way across Greenland. I was bubbling over with enthusiasm. How could I have ignored the classic route across Greenland and only walked around dreaming of following in Amundsen's footsteps to the South Pole? Whom could I persuade to accompany me? My partner didn't even look up. He had no taste for camping and was definitely not fired up by the thought of an expedition of this kind. During the days that followed, it was as if I was possessed by Greenland. The more interest I showed in the project, the quieter my partner became. As the weeks passed, he began to understand that my dream would become reality, and not long after, I found myself alone, again. This was nothing new. My taste for advanced outdoor activities and an independent life had always been an obstacle in previous relationships, because it often introduced an element of competition. It was perfectly acceptable, if not entirely legitimate, that the men in my life had stimulating interests. But when I sought the same stimulation, they regarded me as a competitor. The majority of them disliked competition. It was never my intention to defeat them in time or distance. I merely felt that I had the same right to test myself. I couldn't help being physically strong. To make things more difficult, I didn't have typical feminine interests. The other wives and girlfriends didn't clamber up mountain faces, and so at parties I always found myself in the men's corner. Naturally, I was expected to stay with the ladies and stick to fashion, interior decoration, and child rearing. I did try.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?